Today on Against the Grain, we think of public utilities operating for the public good. It's right there in the name. But most public utilities are investor-owned, and like corporations as a whole in this country, have enormous power to dispossess poor people through government-backed mechanisms like eminent domain. I'm Sasha Lilly. I'll speak with sociologist Loka Ashwood about how such dispossession, along with state-sanctioned corporate tax breaks and limits on corporate liability, lead poor rural people to distrust the government. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. Why are poor rural people often anti-government? Is it because they're conservative and against state intervention for the public good, which is the conventional wisdom held by many liberals? Or is it because they rightly see the state as the handmaiden of corporations that throw them off their meager property, pollute their rivers, and starve their regions of tax revenue? In For-Profit Democracy, Why the Government is Losing the Trust of Rural America, part of the Yale Agrarian Studies series, Loka Ashwood looks at Burke County, Georgia, the home of the Vogtle nuclear power plant, and how the residents of the area, black and white, have responded to corporate dispossession and the impunity granted by the government. She's Assistant Professor of Agricultural Economics and Rural Sociology at Auburn University and joins me today. Loka, can you start by painting a picture of who lives in Burke County and about the poverty of the area?
So at the county level, it's basically split down the level, half black and half white. The poverty is acute. So it's 33.5% of the people who live there live in poverty. It's one of the persistent poverty counties. It's part of what we call a belt that stretches across the South, what sociologists and Du Bois's tradition we call the Black Belt, meaning reflective of race. But you'll often have a lot of people just from the South who are speaking of the soil when they use the phrase Black Belt, because it goes back to the plantation structure in the South. And so this persistent poverty classification that exists for Burke County, there's only, I believe it's about 11% of counties in the nation that are that poor. And that means that you have for 30 years, three U.S. census periods, your population has been 20% or higher in poverty. And so Burke County is one of those counties. It's persistently poor.
Well, tell us about where people work and the centrality of the nuclear industry in Burke County.
The Vogtle nuclear reactors are owned by Southern Company, and Southern Company is one of the largest utilities in the United States. It's a Fortune 500 company. It built Vogtle units 1 and 2 in the 70s, and now it has Vogtle units 3 and 4 under construction, estimated to be online and running in 2021-2022. The centrality of that industry to the actual people that live there, That's a really important question, but it's a distinct one because of the people that I interviewed. There are not a lot of jobs locally for people who live there at the plant. It was a running joke among some people just to sit at a stop sign and count the number of cars that would go by at the end of a shift and to see how many faces you would know of those flying past to the nearby urban area of Augusta. And so the joke would kind of go, you wouldn't see anyone that you know.
And I'd like to ask you more about how the plant does affect daily life there. But let me ask you about the significance of the reactors that are being built right now. You said that of the four, two were built in the 70s, and now these other ones are in progress. On a national level, why is it significant that these are being built?
So there's no other nuclear reactors under construction in the United States right now. So the total operating numbers, the last time I checked, there's 61 sites across the country with 99 active reactors operating at those 61 sites. And this is significant because it already has two operating and it's going to have another two if they go online in 2021, 2022. So that would make four active reactors. It's a really important site because, like I said, this isn't happening anywhere else. Burke County, Georgia is the only place where new construction is happening because some other projects were canceled. The money just hasn't been there. In fact, just last month, the government has backed nuclear power extensively. There was a federal loan guarantee that before was $8.3 billion, but just in the last month, I believe it was in the end of March, the federal government gave another $3.7 billion federal loan guarantee, bring that up to $12 billion. So the reason why they're giving that federal loan guarantee is because it's hard to find anybody who privately will invest or fund these things because they're highly risky and the construction costs have really ballooned. It's stretching up over $30 billion now just for these two new reactors. And so that federal loan guarantee means that if something happens, if the worst were to happen, and there was some sort of a disaster, or if a Southern company or its subsidiary Georgia Power would go bankrupt, taxpayers would eat that $12 billion. So it's guaranteed in the case of default, you could say.
And this gets to one of the central arguments that you make in your book, For Profit Democracy, which is that what get called public services or public goods, like power generation, are really inseparable from the government, although they are part of the private sector and they are referred to as public utilities. What gets sort of muddied in all of this is that while they're not necessarily operating for the public good, their existence is entirely bound up with the government.
Yes, it's a dynamic that took me a while to try to piece through because when I came to Burke County, it really wasn't on my radar that Southern Company and its subsidiary, Georgia Power, which is the one in the Southern Nuclear, which are the subsidiaries that are prevalent there. I had no idea that they had so many public rights. And in terms of public rights, I initially thought of it traditionally, as we all do. You think about public goods, things that are accessible to everyone, that serve to the benefit of the entire population and serve higher purposes and moral goods and value that we see as most important to democracy. But what I realized when I was there, it was through the use of eminent domain that I really started to become more and more interested in the very blurred, almost non-existent lines between private and public in Burke County, because what I discovered, and I shouldn't even say discovered, folks there knew it was going on for so long, but sociologists talk very little about it. Never have we really talked about it in rural America. There's some work done by a sociologist in Philadelphia on the use of eminent domain. But what I realized is that Georgia Power was able to threaten or use eminent domain to take people's land. And eminent domain is, according to the Bill of Rights, you can only forcibly take private property for public use. And so private property for public use. And so that's when I started thinking, well, how is it that Georgia Power, a subsidiary of a for-profit company, can use eminent domain to take private land? And so that's when I started to get really interested and concerned with what the meaning of public was in terms of the constitutional defense, in terms of property, but then also just interested in how the corporation at large has gained so much power. Because you mentioned utilities, and of course utilities have a monstrous amount of power in terms of they're not only, in this case, it's not only a private corporation, but as a utility, it says, okay, look, I'm producing a public good. So I have specific rights of use of eminent domain and specific claims to public because I am producing electricity, and electricity is better for all. So it takes on this sort of utilitarian argument that since this is better for everyone, even though these folks in Burke County may have to suffer, oh well, this is for the public good overall because we're producing a product that everyone needs. And so the Supreme Court has backed that as being public good and as a public good. And that happened a long time ago, one of the main rulings that had to do with that actually came out of Alabama, which is, I found interesting. It was Supreme Court ruling on Alabama Power Company against Mount Vernon Woodbury Company. It was basically the Supreme Court said that something like water was waste until you put some sort of attention or industrious activity to it. And then it was turned into something that could be purchased. So that was deemed to be synonymous with public use. And that really kind of paved the way for utilities to claim public status by saying, okay, well, you know, that the Savannah River running down by the Vogtle nuclear reactors, that would just be waste, except for the fact that we're now using that water to cool our reactors. And we're taking something that formerly had no value, although I would disagree with that. I'd say it had great value and still does for people who live there. But they would make the argument that it had no value because nobody was making money off of it. And so utility companies have been able to use that argument and also saying that electricity is key to industrialization. It's key to modernization. It's key to modern culture, our everyday lives, that we have special rights because we are producing power. And because of that, on a state-by-state basis, every state in the country gives utilities extra powers of public use. And so they have extra capacity to be able to use eminent domain to take people's lands. So that's how I kind of finally circle back to figuring out, well, how in the world is it that Georgia Power can take somebody else's land, not even necessarily have any active operations on it, but just take it because it's proximate to their site? Well, they can do that because they say it's in service of the public good, even though they are a profit-seeking corporation.
I'm speaking with sociologist Loka Ashwood about her book, For Profit Democracy, Why the Government is Losing the Trust of Rural Americans. My name is Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So tell us more about how eminent domain works. How particularly does the right to eminent domain, how has it worked in this county that you studied, Burke County, Georgia, where the Vogtle nuclear reactors are located?
Well, there's kind of two ways that eminent domain works, and there's one that I'm primarily interested in, and that's the threat of it. So what's most powerful is the threat of eminent domain. If someone comes up to you, and what's happened in Burke County, Georgia, is someone approaches you about your property, which may be an 80-acre cotton field or maybe a homestead that you have, and they say that, look, I'm the Georgia Power Company. I am seeking to purchase your land. You may respond by saying, well, no, I don't want to sell you your land. Georgia Power Company can then respond and say, well, you may not want to, but you have to sell us your land. And across the country, from what I know, whether any private corporation that has the capacity to claim public use and use eminent domain, when they decide to do that, there's not a whole lot you can do to stop them. You can quibble over the price, as one of the people that I interviewed told me. He pushed to get a little bit more for his acreage. But you can not stop them from taking it if they so choose. Now, you can be perhaps enough of a problem for them. There's ways in which they may decide to go around you. I've heard of some cases like that. But in Burke County, what's happened is Black and white folks who live in the area have largely been dispossessed. So over 41% of the land that exists in the 5-mile radius around the Vogtle nuclear reactors is either owned by the Georgia Power Company or owned by the state of Georgia itself. And when I looked back at old property records, so I went back to 1966, and that's the last time in Burke County that they divided what they titled colored property from white property, there was no corporate or state ownership of land at that time. So it's by virtue of this facility that there's been a widespread transfer and land ownership from the local community to the corporation and the state.
And I wonder if you could take us back a bit further in time to understand how eminent domain came to be used extensively, because part of this is the history that, although you're focusing on the circumstances of this so-called public-private partnership, in Burke County, Georgia, around this nuclear reactor and how it affects the lives of the people in that region profoundly. What you're also saying is the entanglement, the intense entanglement of the public and the private, of for-profit companies and the government is actually one of the hallmarks of the economy in the United States. And so I wonder if you could just take us back to some of this earlier history of the government stepping in to make it possible for railroads and utilities to be viable and the role of eminent domain in that.
Yes, that's an excellent question. So I think to answer that, I need to just talk about the corporation for a bit. So I became very interested backwards, as you said, about what how corporations had so much power, how I really, it's like a corporate state alliance that you've heard elsewhere, or the corporation is absolutely central, as you said, to the way that the U.S. economy works right now. I came to that backwards because I talked to folks and they started expressing these grievances and this dismay at how in a country that they believe to be democratically operated and governed, this sort of thing could happen. And so I went back in time to try to figure out the history of the corporation that's made it have both status as public and private. So one thing I talk about in the book is how the corporation, it's come to have preeminent rights in terms of both. It prevails as the ultimate generator of profit, the ultimate holder of property rights, because there's so many property rights like shares, derivatives, securities, and limited liability risk that make it more powerful. But it also has that status as public, as we've been talking about in terms of the utility. And then the corporation is also has been deemed to be a person, an actual individual. So there's a lot of different Supreme Court rulings that have kind of shaped how it has those four different dimensions of great power through property, the public, you know, personal status and profit. So in terms of the individual, what I found is that corporations have gained so much power in the United States predominantly through transportation and energy production. So it goes back to those sorts of industries that were considered to be necessary for industrial growth. So that's why, especially as part of the Yale Agrarian Studies series, that this is so important to understanding what's happened to agriculture in rural areas. We just have to understand the corporation. So the corporation gained intense power as an individual by virtue of the railroad. So there's that 1886 Santa Clara versus Southern Pacific Railroad Company. That is when there was that germinal ruling where you had Southern Pacific Railroad trying to pay lesser taxes. Everything ultimately, I don't know if it's the time of the year, but it comes down to taxes. I'm seeing that more and more with the corporations. They didn't want to have to pay a special tax for being a corporation. And so they advocated, so it's cruel and unusual for you to treat us differently than you would any individual on the street. And so we think that we should be taxed as an individual. And based off of that 1886 ruling, you have corporate status as an individual extrapolated through other rulings and spreading on to the corporation getting Fourth Amendment rights, like the protection from unreasonable searches and seizures that happened 1906. And then after that, you had where states could no longer have the power to tax corporations at a higher rate. Building on that, that became unconstitutional. And then this builds up into things more recently, like the Citizens United ruling, where corporations have they actually have free speech rights to donate to political campaigns. So all of this compiles to create their power. But that's just in the sense of preeminent in terms of person. You know, they're preeminent in terms of property rights because anybody who's working on their taxes right now, the new tax code, for example, you can get more deductions if you're funneling your money through a corporation. It doesn't just stop at like a funnel through with a subsidiary structure like we have with Southern Company and Georgia Power. It also happens through the very types of forms of property that we have that make corporations more powerful. So especially in rural areas that I'm interested in, and we see this happening in terms of farmland financialization and other trends as well, is people who have their ownership of land connected to their name, they're increasingly less powerful as farmland or land that's owned by a corporation is more powerful, because if they go bankrupt, they don't bear the same risks or liabilities in terms of a proprietary owner or a personal owner like you or me. So their property rights are more powerful because of the government has created markets and a legal apparatus to make them so. And then their power in terms of public status, I talked somewhat about that with the Alabama Power Company ruling. But just to say even more on that, there's some recent rulings, are more recent as in the last 60, 70 years, and then just in the last, I think Kilo versus City of New London was in 2005. That more recently, public, the very phrase of public, what public means in terms of the capacity to use eminent domain, has changed markedly. So there was the Berman versus Parker ruling in the 1950s. And that ruling basically said that any reduction, if you're reducing urban blight, blight broadly conceived, and you can imagine that blight often means poverty, right? Or people who have less. Mm-hmm. So in that ruling, it said that, you know, if you get rid of blight, we're going to say that you're doing something in the public good. Well, that ruling has been a monstrosity for people of lesser means. So it's saying that if we need to do some urban development by this private development company, they can go ahead and do that because they can claim that people who have less money live in more of a status of blight. And that, remarkably, the Supreme Court said is in service of the public good. Now, that extended even more recently in the Kilo versus City of New London ruling. That's the 2005 one where I don't know if you ever saw anything about the Little Pink House. But tell you about the Little Pink House. So Suzette Kilo had her little pink house that she just was not going to sell. She refused to give it up for economic development purposes. Part of it was a Pfizer development, and also there's supposed to be a shopping mall where her house and a few others were. To make a long story short, she lost the case, and as a result, her house was the area where her house was and others. It was demolished, and Pfizer was supposed to build a compound there, and there was supposed to be some sort of shopping mall go into place, and it never happened. It never actually happened. They pulled out of the deal, and that ruling basically said that any economic development project that offers to produce more tax revenue, if it's going to produce more tax revenue, that's in the public good. So, and it doesn't even really mean more tax revenue. I think we can challenge it on that basis, because what they really mean is more tax revenue within a very specific consolidated space, similar to the Vogtle reactors. You have a lot of economic generation in a small space, but you have this much broader ruling that dispossesses a lot of taxpayers on a broader scale, and that we don't have the capacity to track as well. So really what they're saying is producing more revenue is in the public good, probably isn't even doing that. But even if it was, it's a very dangerous precedent to say that your property rights matter if you can make more money than somebody else's. And that's where we have this real challenge to democracy, especially for the rural people that I talk to in Burke County and that I talk to and work elsewhere, is because they see property rights. And you can maybe see that this building, this explanation building, as to they're one of the few ways that rural people can protect their rights is through their property. And with the capacity to use eminent domain to take it away and the rising corporate capacity, that's shaping the rural distrust of the state and becoming more and more estranged from formal politics.
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is Sasha Lilly, and today I'm speaking with Loka Ashwood about her book, For Profit Democracy, Why the Government is Losing the Trust of Rural Americans, and that's published by Yale University Press. She's assistant professor in the Department of Agricultural Economics and Rural Sociology at Auburn University. And her book looks at the situation in Burke County, Georgia, where through things like eminent domain, a public utility has damaged the lives of people in the county and also their reaction to those circumstances. Loka, you mentioned limited liability, and a phrase that I think is familiar to people in the limited liability corporation. What is the origin of the limited liability corporation, and how does it end up holding those who own corporations to a totally different standard than, mm-hmm. say, somebody who gets underwater with their mortgage and can't pay?
Mm-hmm. That's a great question. So here's where I think the origin is, although I'm sure legal scholars could be better equipped to answer that, but I'll give you my answer. So I see limited liability as tracing back to the very roots of eminent domain in the early 1800s. That's where I see it coming from, because at that time, corporations would not have been able to take land if they had to give the full just compensation, the way of which it was conceived of as at that time in the United States. So just compensation in context of the forcible taking of land would have included future earnings lost. So you can imagine in the context of farming, the many cattle or the many crops that could be raised on a piece of property, and the multi, not just within your own lifetime, but the multi-generational earnings that could compile on that property. So when the railroad and canals were initially being constructed in this country, juries would award substantial dollar amounts to private property owners whose land was forcibly taken through eminent domain based on a much broader view of what just compensation meant. And that was bankrupting corporations. So in response, those the capacity to award monies based on more than just the current market value began to collapse. And so that's where I really see the roots of limited liability coming from. I think it's intricately related to eminent domain. Now, more recently, like just the Slapjack LLC limited liability corporate form, that's changed in more recent legal structure in the late 90s that made it more accessible and cheaper for anybody to form a limited liability corporation like an LLC. Now, in terms of the LLCs that we see cropping up across the United States, the main appeal of that, in addition to tax savings, is that if you go bankrupt, and we see this in other types of structures in rural America besides nuclear, but if you go bankrupt, basically your investors are not liable for the debts incurred. And so, again, this traces back to the foundation of our country as a nation, is that the private investors that pooled the money to create the initial infrastructure for the United States, they could not have afforded to take on that risk without potentially losing it all if they didn't have limited liability, both in terms of giving just compensation to the smaller and the smaller property owners and those with less, but also actually having to pay the debts that they owed. Now, what's remarkable to me about that, and just as you were kind of speaking to Sasha, is that the individual person, as you or I standing, if we invest in something and attach our name to it, and it goes belly up, we lose everything, whether that's our house or a car, or if it's a small business that we haven't incorporated under. And further, limited liability corporations that aren't publicly traded often have corporate veils, meaning that the investor identities are hidden. So in the case of wrongdoing, unless malicious intent can be proven, so unless somebody has an email that said that you meant to pollute my well in my backyard, those names can't be revealed. So it's also a way, I don't write about this as much in the book, but in industrial agriculture, I write about this a lot. It's a way to keep people from knowing who's backing these companies. And it's a way to keep the money hidden from the consequences. And while there's really dramatic examples of that, of this, it's also more mundane. It's just the way that we often try to have a Roth IRA an account, retirement account, or account that we're saving in to pay for our kids' education, and we don't see where that money actually goes. So the way that liability is limited, it's quite structural, but it's also just it's effusive in ways I don't think we think about perhaps enough. We've become numbed to paying attention to where our money goes and the consequences of how that has real impacts on the lives of many people. And I see it particularly acute in rural America across many different dimensions. But in the context of this book, it's in terms of energy production. Rural people are dispossessed, and it's contributing to their poverty. And that money is re-aggregated in shareholder pockets that are not in people who, by and large, are not living in rural places.
Well, let's talk more about the specifics of some of the harms that you're talking about. You've mentioned in the context of Georgia Power in Burke County, Georgia, of eminent domain, of people having their property seized by the company. What are the other ways that this company has been able to, with the tacit agreement or even more overt agreement of the government, despoiled the environment and really affected the livelihoods of people in this area?
What's really interesting about the Vogtle nuclear reactors is they're right across the river from in South Carolina, the Savannah nuclear site. So literally, if you're standing at the back of the Vogtle facility and you had a good arm and you threw a stone across the Savannah River, you'd hit the Savannah River site. So they're that close together. So the environmental consequences of Vogtle are not easy to parcel out from those as the Savannah River site. And in fact, I don't have a lot of great information on the consequences of Vogtle, but there's a lot in terms of the Savannah River site, which is a Superfund facility. There's an active set of money to give former workers compensation for contracting cancer because of their exposure. It's a plutonium reprocessing site. So it's arguably one of the most dangerous and polluted sites in the country. So in terms of the environmental degradation that people talk about, the Savannah River runs right along the edge of where I lived and where these folks live at, in the Shell Bluff area is what it's commonly known in Burke County. So it's called Shell Bluff because it goes back to the prehistoric oyster shells that studded the side of a bank beautifully. And the name stuck. And in that area, it was there's some old documentation that you could drink the freshest water ran from an active spring there. And now there's warnings about fishing in the river. People are advised not to swim, not to drink from any of the water. The environmental assessments that have been done by a particular nonprofit group identifies it as the third most polluted in the country. And that's also a result of the paper mills that are upstream from these facilities, from Vogtle, as well as the Savannah River site. So I think one of the other important things to remember when we're thinking about rural contamination of water is that it's effusive, and there's different contributors, water, soil, and air, I should say. So it's, even though we're talking, this book talks a lot about it's very localized in terms of the Vogtle nuclear reactors. There's a lot of other industries in rural areas that are potential contributors to water and air and soil contamination. And what's particularly egregious and dangerous about this is rural wells are they're not legally, they're not monitored, and there's no federally enforceable standards for safe drinking water for rural people. So effectively, they're off the grid in terms of having anyone that's watching their water or having really a legal basis to defend their water, unless that happens through their property rights. So again, that's where this circles back to the value of property rights as a legal mechanism for rural people. It's not just in terms of their background, their family, their money, but it's also in terms of their environment. So the taking of the property rights can take away their capacity to sue for things like nuisance, for polluting my well, for polluting the air. In any contamination that we're talking about in Burke County or really elsewhere in the United States, a lot of rural communities are going to be dealing with different types of contaminants in their water from many different extractive processes that are sited there.
And so given everything you've described, Burke County would seem like the sort of place where the taxes that would be drawn from the companies there would be fundamentally important in terms of some kind of attempt to remediate the vast damage that has been done. Tell us the story of the taxes and what it indicates about the larger argument you're making about the intense complicity of the government in what for-profit, ostensibly private companies are doing.
Yes. So there has been, quite a bit of a revenue windfall anticipated by the county government while I was there in February in 2013. So there was all this ample disappointment and actual local, the animosity was as high as I saw the whole time I was there with local officials. They found out, the Burke County commissioners and the mayors of the various towns found out that the state of Georgia legislator, they'd pushed through a tax code that actually exempted the Georgia Power from paying sales tax on between 90 and 95% of their construction costs. And so this was an absolute shock to the local government because they had been counting on this money. There was actually a local referendum earlier that had approved using the anticipated money to build a new jail and do some other county infrastructure improvements. So instead of the $35 million that they were anticipating, the state legislator what they heard from the legislators is that they could potentially owe they would receive maybe just between $3 and $6.5 million, but they could also potentially owe $1 million in back taxes. So there was this level of complicity that local government officials saw that the state legislature was really handing them over just to whatever ends Southern Company wanted. And that wasn't like the first time around, though. I mean, that's one thing I talk about in the book is that initially when the Vogtle reactors, the first two were built, there was much more a positive sense of the possibilities of what could happen, that this really could make a marked difference in the community. And in fairness, people were very happy that there were good schools built with the funding and that there were emergency management services that far surpassed what was there before. But in sort of an aggregate way of it spreading out amongst the population, that money, it never happened. And then additionally, these new reactors did not bring in the tax revenue that the local government officials were expecting. So not only did I see this acute animosity locally, right in that Shell Bluff area where I lived right around the plant, but it also was very strong amongst the local elected officials after this sort of backdoor tax change that they did not see coming.
I'm speaking with Loka Ashwood about her book, For Profit Democracy, Why the Government is Losing the Trust of Rural Americans. That's published by Yale University Press, part of the Yale Agrarian Studies series. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Well, let's talk about the reactions from the people who live in the county. Now, there's been a lot of attention in the last few years, particularly since Trump was elected, about people in rural areas and why are they so conservative, and a lot of speculation around that. You make an argument that is sort of flips that on its head, which is that you argue that, and this was borne out by the field work you did in interviewing the many people you did for this book, that the kind of mistrust that rural people, especially poor rural people, have toward the state is not misplaced, and it isn't necessarily a indication of their conservatism.
I think that's well put. So the main thing that I think I want the book to get across is that there is a lot new about rural population loss and rural poverty. We're seeing turnarounds and trends that were positive to the negative, like lower life longevity for white rural males. There's new things that are happening and there's differences that are important. I want to say that. But I also think that the book is making the argument that for a very long time, as the history of the corporation supports, rural people have been dispossessed and strategically marginalized in the pursuit of economic development, a very centralized vision of what progress should be and what it should mean. So the trends that I talk about in this book, there are recent changes that have made things particularly bad as of late for rural people. But I think if we just understand this in terms of conservative politics or liberal politics, we miss so much. We miss so much because this what's happening is old and it's so deeply embedded in our legal apparatus that it's going to take major changes in the way democracy works, as well as just the more mundane Supreme Court rulings that continually put the people who have the least in money or the least in numbers on the line. And so what I talk about in the book is that happens in a few ways. So it is, like I mentioned, it's a mixed race area. Right in the area that I lived was a little bit more white than it was black, but I spent time with people across the color line. And in doing so, I started to see that there was multiple layers of minority statuses that compiled. And this isn't a lot different than intersectionality in sense of the broader idea, but it is very different in practice because I'm talking about the structural ways in which the most marginalized continue to be marginalized. And I really want to add in rural as a dimension of marginalization, because I bring in this concept, majority cannibalism. And my point is that you can be a minority one day and a majority the next, or a majority one day and then go back to a minority in the next, because profit has this incessant need to feed. And as part of that need to feed, if you're a rural person who is fairly affluent, as one man that I talk about in the book, you may have missed the forcible land takings the first time the Vogel plant came through. The second time, you're not able to dodge it because profit it constantly needs to feed. So while the black folks who lived in the area experienced much more land takings, at least in terms of what I have found out in interviews, and received a lower price by all accounts of those that I spoke to. Now it's more white families that are being dispossessed because there's more white owners. So there's this kind of there's this capacity to think that, oh, in the time that I'm in right now, perhaps I can escape this minority status and this loss. But it circles back around to capture those who are even in majority status because profit always needs to feed. And I say that because I have two chapters in the book that are just dedicated to, as you mentioned, the political responses. How do people react is what I call it, to these structural changes, this dispossession that they're experiencing. And in the black community, I saw it as articulated as part of the system. So the black community blames the system for systematic dispossession. And that, of course, goes back to slavery. For many of these families have grown up hearing about stories of slavery, and that structural disadvantage is, of course, still there. But how do you overcome the system? They see God as the ultimate means in faith. So to overcome a system, they see a need to actually transcend that system. Whereas with the white folks who are dispossessed that I talk to, they see it more as the government to blame because they're still in a situation of which their grievances are more isolated because they haven't had the same extent of minority upon minority upon minority status and dispossession over generations and generations. So they still see the government as to blame, generally even subsuming the corporation, Southern Company, within to the government, whereas black residents saw racial oppression as part of the dispossession and so articulated it differently as the system. And so within that, there's this sort of incapacity to talk across the color line about these issues because they're understood differently, although the grievance is very similar in the current times.
Did you witness any translation of these grievances into activism? And if not, where did those energies go?
Okay, so in terms of the white community, I did not see organized action. In sense of the collective means of which we often expect, and especially as sociologists, there's this expectation that if people are protesting, there's one way that that happens, and they get together and they protest as a group. And that's traditionally the way that we've traced what collective action means and what social movements are. But what I was trying to push for in this book is that for people who are very marginalized by the government and people who have a distrust of the state rooted in longstanding grievances, they're not going to necessarily come together to a community forum. John Gaventa wrote about this in his book, Power and Powerlessness, many years ago in rural Appalachia. But what I'm talking about here is taking that even a step further, because I see the corporation as the for-profit corporation as an active element of governance. I don't think that the people that I talked to were wrong in terms of the way that they saw it, because that's the way the actual land takings played out. So for them, pushing back against the government through a government institution or a government sanctioned process doesn't make much sense. So you see what I call, I have a chapter called The Rural Rebel, where historians have documented this in other contexts as well, but where people actually take to the land, they poach, they trespass without remorse on the land that they think that was unjustly taken. And it's this sort of almost a little bit like a David Graeber direct democracy, but in a sense, there's some elements of anarchism there, because when the government no longer seems to represent the people, the white folks that I talked to predominantly turned to poaching and trespassing. Now, there is a Shell Bluff Concerned Citizens group that is predominantly Black. I saw one white resident join the group. She came in a local white landowner who attended a meeting, but predominantly it's Black residents who have formed this group just situated around one church. But what I write about in the book is that they don't see the government as the pathway for reform. They see God as the pathway for reform. So it's faith in the church that's their guiding light. And the government is just, you know, something that we have to deal with. So it's almost like a tangent. It's not the primary means through which to accomplish something. So my overall argument is that the Black residents, as well as the white residents together, do not see the government really as a very effective means for reform, and act out their grievances in very different ways that are racially articulated and wrapped up in that systematic oppression versus government oppression.
Well, let me end by asking a much broader question, which is that you write that 68% of Americans get their energy from investor-owned utilities. And what you're describing as taking place in Burke County, Georgia, while particularly acute and kind of appalling, that the absolute interpenetration of private companies and the state, particularly mm-hmm. as they relate to public utilities, but also beyond that, that is a national phenomenon. And so I wanted to ask you if you drew any conclusions from studying this in the particular and also more broadly about if there are any openings for opposing that dynamic, especially given that there is this ideology that private for-profit companies have, that they just follow the market and they are, in effect, they are not tied to the government. I mean, that's mm-hmm. that's the way we hear it. Except, of course, if there is then a crisis. You know, here in California, mm-hmm. it's easy to think of PG&E, which is implicated in starting wildfires, and the incredible difficulty of holding such an entity mm-hmm. to account, mm-hmm. given its both the support of the state and interpenetration with the state.
Such an important question. And I'm going to say that I like to start small. And the thing that I found most telling and helpful, and I've seen mostly through teaching and in the ways that I came to understand what was going on there myself, is just learning about what the corporation is and calling it out by its name, just saying it's a fictitious legal entity that could never exist without the government. Just in us saying that, it switches, you know, that ideology that you're talking about, the ideology that we think that the market is ultimately effective and efficient and whatever makes the most money is by far the most virtuous. And obviously what has the most money is a sort of Protestant work ethic product. But when you start to look at how the corporation has a monopoly, how it is held up by the state, it starts to collapse those lines that we have between what is private and what is public, and what is market and what is private property. And it's like it requires a reframing of the problem. And in reframing it, it gives people a lot of power because they're able to break out of those molds of thinking where we can say, well, if a corporation really is just made by the government, then why don't we look at other types of corporate structures that maybe have governance where all of the profit goes back to the workers instead of anonymous investors? Or what about if you're going to get lucky enough to have that corporate structure and you're going to not have to have risk liabilities? Let's go back to the early 1800s when that meant that everybody actually got to have free and public use to that, if you get to be a corporation. So it's, I think it's ways of starting simple and then getting bigger from there. And a lot of the ideas in the book are on that kind of meta level, but that in just changing the way that we think about these things and collapsing those strong dividing lines that we have right now that's between public and private, and showing that, hey, it's already murky, so let's just make it what we want it to be. I think that could, that can help a lot. And I don't think that I'm just an idealist on that, because I've witnessed people as they've learned about these differences, and as I've learned about these differences, I think there's great optimism then. It's like through the understanding of what the corporation is and who it should actually be accountable to, it's no longer like we're up against these all-powerful, beautiful operating actors that are beyond us because they're so ultimately efficient. Instead, we understand them as created to have their advantages. And if they're created to have their advantages, then they owe something back to the people who've enabled them to have those advantages. And so I see great optimism there. And on another practical level, there's a nuclear operator that I interviewed in the second chapter of the book. And he said that he put it most poignantly. He said, you know, your meter can run backward if you have solar panels and these more small scale, localized forms of energy production. I know we've heard it over and over again, but I'm just going to say it again. When we decentralize energy production, you also make responsibility more a few. So many have responsibility rather than a few who, even within the bureaucratic apparatus of these large corporations, they don't even know everything that's happening because it's impossible to. And it's frustrating for the people who are working in these corporations as well. So I see a grid of energy production that's not so centralized in these massive projects that, as Jim Scott has argued, are very risky and often fail. We can have a better future for rural people and for urban people together by just having the energy grid and the production sites more widely distributed.
Luca Ashwood, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
I've been speaking with Luca Ashwood about her book, For Profit Democracy, Why the Government is Losing the Trust of Rural Americans. That's published by Yale University Press. On againstthegrain.org, you can find a link to that book. Luca Ashwood is assistant professor in the Department of Agricultural Economics and Rural Sociology at Auburn University. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening. And please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.